The New Testament authors often looked back to the Old Testament and saw Christ as fulfilling certain prophecies, and we heard that in the Gospel today. And the Gospel of Luke is a little bit less than the others because Luke is writing to a Gentile audience who wouldn't know all of those Old Testament references, so he doesn't go into that as much as Matthew does. But Matthew likes to show Jesus to be the new Moses. And so out of Egypt I have called my son. You know, Moses rescues people from slavery in Egypt and brings them, delivers them into the promised land. Jesus rescues us from sin and death and delivers us into the kingdom of God. There's also a reference to Joseph here. Joseph, the husband of Mary, responds to a dream that he has to take Mary and the child to escape to Egypt because of the edict of Herod to kill all the firstborn male children in Israel. And so Moses has a similar story. The Pharaoh has decreed that all the firstborn male children of the Hebrews would be killed. And so Moses is put by his mother into a basket, and he floats down the Nile and miraculously escapes that edict. So again, Jesus is the new Moses, and similar stories surround both of their births. Also a reference here to Jacob, who is also known as Israel. Jacob and Israel are the same person, and those two names are used interchangeably for that person. Okay, Jacob had 12 sons, and they become the 12 tribes of Israel. And the youngest of his sons, who was actually the half-brother of the others, because their mother had died and he remarried, and so he gets sold into slavery by his half-brothers and ends up down in Egypt, where he prospers and becomes a significant person in the government of Egypt. And then later on, when a famine takes place where his brothers are living, they and their father all come down, and there's a reconciliation, and Joseph helps them. Jesus is reconciled with his brothers and sisters. As he hangs upon the cross, "Father, forgive them, they don't know what they're doing." So Jesus is all about reconciliation. He reconciles humanity with the Father. And so wonderful references going on in these readings today. But it's also the Feast of the Holy Family, and so that first reading is about family life. And the second reading, though, really, I think, ties the two together because it shows what it looks like to be family, what it looks like to be a member of the human race, of the family of God, of the kingdom of God. So he starts out, Paul, by saying, "Put on Christ." And I love these references of putting on, as if you were putting on clothing. But there's a reference here, I think, to the baptismal garment. We put on the baptismal garment, which is to put on Christ when we're baptized. And so if you've witnessed at Easter, for example, the baptisms of those adults at the Easter vigil, you see them wearing albs. That's the baptismal garment. But if you've seen, and many of you have witnessed, children's baptisms, and we have a special baptismal garment that goes over them too. So they're putting on Christ. And so what does it look like to put on Christ? Well, Paul goes on and explains that it's about humility. It's about willingness to submit to another's will. It's about willingness to be self-sacrificing all the way to death. And so the eternal Son of God, the second person of the Trinity, one of the great characteristics of that person in the Godhead is submission. He submits to the Father's will. He is willing to be eternally begotten of the one who is his equal. He is not less than the Father, but out of submission, he willingly accepts being begotten by the Father. And then later, when he becomes human flesh, he submits to the authority of Mary and Joseph, even though he is their creator. You know, there's a wonderful, ironic kind of submission that characterizes the Son. And so, Paul ends that second reading by telling wives to be submissive to their husbands like Christ, who is willing to submit to one who is his equal. Her husband is her equal, but she willingly submits to him. And it goes the other way too. He submits to her even though he is her equal. And children submit themselves to the authority of parents. In other words, successful family life has to do with becoming Christ. It has to do with taking on that humble, submissive, self-sacrificing love that is exemplified in the Son. Self-sacrifice is what love is. We say this so often here in the Trinity. They're all three offering themselves completely. Self-sacrifice is what love is. It's what God is. In the old rite of marriage, back before Vatican II, there was an instruction that the priest was supposed to give at every marriage, what we would now call a homily. And for all of the church's sacramental rites, there are instructions or homilies or directives given in the ritual itself. So for ordination, for example, ordination of deacons, priests, and bishops, there is a homily given right in the rite itself. And the bishop, is encouraged to read that. They never do. They all think they can do better. I'm sorry. And I have to admit, when I was the evil diocesan administrator, I was given the opportunity to preach at Father Andy Hamecky's ordination. Some of you were probably there. And I didn't follow that text either, so I'm as bad as the bishops. Okay, so in this exhortation that was in the old rite of marriage, it was a beautiful exhortation, and I've sometimes taken parts of it in wedding homilies today. But this is the part about self-sacrifice, and it's really well worded. It is most fitting that you rest the security of your wedded life upon the great principle of self-sacrifice. Sacrifice is usually difficult and irksome. Only love can make it easy, and perfect love can make it a joy. We are willing to give in proportion as we love. And when love is perfect, the sacrifice is complete. Don't we practice this in the Mass every Sunday? It's about self-sacrifice. It's about offering ourselves on the altar along with Christ. Sacrifice of the Old Testament, you know, where you were sacrificing animals or cereal offerings or incense offerings or something like that, something outside of yourself. And the prophets were always saying, I hate your incense, you know, putting words in God's mouth. What I want is self-sacrifice. What I want is love. What I want is transformed hearts. And so Jesus perfects the sacrificial model. He does away with the temple. He overturns the money changers' tables. He does away with the whole system of animal sacrifice, and he replaces it with his own body. He becomes the victim. He becomes the sacrifice himself. And so in the Mass, this is the memorial of that sacrifice of Christ and our joining ourselves to it in self-sacrificing love. This is what transforms us into Christ over and over again. It deepens our union with him, and it also deepens our union with one another. It's interesting that this Feast of the Holy Family was established in the early part of the 20th century, around 1904 or 5, somewhere in there, by Pius X. And the reason he instituted this Feast of the Holy Family was because there was such a deterioration of family life. And, you know, the modern era had destroyed families and all that sort of thing. And we in 2019 can look back 100 years and say, really? Every generation thinks it has the most difficulty raising children. Every generation has always said that. But look at the Holy Family. Mary was found pregnant before she was married. They were political refugees who had to go down to Egypt. And then when they got back, they had to go to a different city than they grew up in because of tyranny. Joseph had to raise a child that was not his own. Mary had seven sorrows, including losing Jesus in the temple and watching him die on the cross. There is no perfect family. They show us how in great trial and stress, one can live in holiness. One can overcome the difficulties of their age, of their family circumstances. And as long as you are in God, somehow it's going to work out. And so we trust in that the same as Mary and Joseph did.